All right, well, we are finishing up chapter 8 and spend most of our time in chapter 9 tonight in Judges, and it is not not a nice story. Imagine that in Judges. But not a happy story tonight, but hopefully some lessons to learn and a good exhibition of human nature, of what people are capable of in their sin. And so I titled the message, The Sins of the Father, mainly because, not because the sins of the Father are always visited on the next generation, but sometimes they are, right? There is collateral damage to sin. I'm not talking about a salvation idea, and Jesus pretty much blew this out of the water, right, with the apostles when they said, why was that guy born blind? Was it his sin or his parents' sin? And Jesus says, neither. That's not what this is about. Okay? But it'd be ignorant to say that there are no consequences, right? And so if we go back to Exodus 20 with the Ten Commandments, and I thought this was interesting just because of the context of what we've been talking about in the Gideon story. Notice what it says. It says, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. So we're in the Ten Commandments, right? Or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. So verse 4 is all about idolatry. Okay? Don't make idols. And then verse 5 says, thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God. And look what he says next. Visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. So there is collateral damage to sin that can be passed down. The struggles that parents have, children often have similar struggles. Have you seen that? Okay. I'm acutely aware of that sort of thing, being the son of two alcoholic parents, right? Because in my younger years, I could see the same proclivities, even though I watched how destructive it was and how awful it was and how terrible the upbringing was to live in that house. I shared some of the same personality traits that could lead me down the same road. You know, it's messed up, and yet you still possess some of that. And I think that's what's being talked about here. But verse 6 is awesome because he says, in showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Right. So it's not an absolute thing. If you continue to hate me and rebel against me and worship these idols, don't be surprised when the sins go from generation to generation. But if you'll turn back to me and you will love me and you will follow my commandments, then that's off the table, right? I will honor those people, you see? So so when we get to Abimelech here, who is the epitome of carrying on his father's negative legacy, he went down that path. You know, it wasn't an uncontrollable thing. He indulged in his sin rather than listening to God. So we left off last week in 832 with Gideon's death. Right? He died a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash's father at Ophrah of the Abiezrites. So here's the idea. You've got to remember, Gideon was serving as king. Maybe not called king, but functioning as the king, at least of a good portion of Israel. And what seems to happen, especially in the ancient world, when a king dies, there's a power vacuum, right? And somebody has to fill it, and as you know from, you know, science classes and whatnot, nature abhors a vacuum. Something will fill that spot, right? And I found a kind of pretty cool quote that went along with this, is that nature abhors a vacuum. When a head lacks brains, nature fills it with conceit. Hey, we guys like to say, you know, what are you thinking about? Nothing. Well, we're probably thinking about something. But, you know, if you're not thinking, then ignorance will fill that void very quickly. Right. So I think that's what we're going to see here. So let's start in Judges 8, 33 to 35 and finish that chapter. And it came to pass as soon as Gideon was dead, right? They had just kind of closed up the tomb, that the children of Israel turned again and went a whoring after Balaam and made Baal Berith their God. And the children of Israel remembered not the Lord their God, who had delivered them out of the hands of all their enemies on every side. And neither showed they kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, namely Gideon, according to all the goodness which he had shown unto Israel. So it's an interesting ending to chapter 8. 8's kind of our setting up our prologue to what we're going to talk about tonight. So remember, last time we left Gideon, he had set up that ephod. cult back in Ophrah. They were doing idolatry, and yet he seems to kind of have there's a little bow on his story here at the end. The final verse of chapter 8 seemed to indicate that Gideon's reign actually inhibited Israel's descent into idolatry. He was sponsoring idolatry, but I guess the point is it would have been even worse had Gideon not been there. Remember, I kind of talked about this last week. Gideon was not necessarily breaking the first commandment. He was breaking the second commandment. So Gideon was probably still saying, you know, Yahweh's still our number one, but we're just going to do all this other stuff as well. We're going to worship him kind of illegitimately in that. And it seems like he at least held it to a reasonable level. As soon as he dies, the floodgates open and idolatry is everywhere. And they're violating the first commandment. They have thrown God out and are now worshiping an entire another God. Okay. So Israel, with our good King James language there, went a whoring. Okay. It's a weird way to say it. I don't know. Language has changed. And they went a-whoring with this new Baal, this Baal Berith. It literally means Lord or Baal of the Covenant, which I think is important. Because what linked Yahweh back to Israel? It was the covenant. They were the covenant people of God, right? And now they trade Yahweh in for Baal of the Covenant. So they have linked themselves. They have pledged themselves to Baal. This is not, okay, I worship God on Sundays, but I go over on this day and do the pagan thing every now and then, local deity. This is, I don't worship this God anymore. I worship a new God. I have a covenant with a new God. That's how serious it is. So who is it? Well, when we get to 946, it says, when all the leaders of the Tower of Shechem heard of it, they entered the stronghold of the house of El-Berith. I think Baal-Berith and El-Berith are the same God. Seems to be kind of the patron god of Shechem, a Canaanite city. And it seems that the Canaanite gods have now got a foothold in Israel now that Gideon is dead. So that's who they're worshiping. Okay. Now remember the thesis back in chapter 2. When the Lord raised them up judges, then the Lord was with the judge and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For it repented the Lord because of their groanings by reason of them that oppressed them and vexed them. And verse 19, and it came to pass when the judge was dead that they returned and corrupted themselves more than their fathers in following other gods to serve them and to bow down unto them. They ceased not from their own doings nor from their stubborn way. So they're just fulfilling what has already been prophesied about what's going to happen. When the judge died, things went downhill. There was a vacuum, and idolatry seemed to always fill that vacuum. And that's what always jumped into the spot. So Israel was already worshiping Baal at Gideon's cult installation in Ophrah, and now they make Baal-Berith their god, moving beyond the mere idolatry with local deities. They've displaced Yahweh with a new Lord of the Covenant. They reverse the order. Instead of the Lord calling Israel out of the nations, now Israel calls their own god out of the nations. Yeah, you see how they kind of bizarro this thing all the way around. And then it says they remembered not Yahweh, okay? Which is an interesting way to put it, because that sounds like they got amnesia all of a sudden and they forgot who Yahweh was. Okay? That's not what's happening. Okay? It's not, it's been so long, we don't even remember who that person is. We don't quite remember his name. Who was that God again? That's not what's going on here. Remember, this is the God that had rescued them. This is the God that has delivered them from Egypt, and how many times since then has delivered them. They know who Yahweh is. It's they're failing to acknowledge him. They're failing to forsake allegiance to pagan gods. They're failing to worship him as he deems worship fit. He has saved them and they have walked away. Okay? That's what it means when they remember him not. Okay? And then Israel in the house of Gideon. Gideon was full of flaws here, but he was called by God. He was a deliverer. He was used by God to rid them of the Midianites. And they should have shown him respect at the very least. Right. Even if he's got his flaws, this is the guy that drove the Midianites out, that had all those years of terror in the land. And for some reason, the gratitude, the respect has dissipated and they've gotten distracted. They've forgotten what Gideon did for them, which kind of tells you a lot about human nature. Right. When you get really full of yourself and you think you're really important, just realize that one day somebody will probably forget about what you've done too. Okay? And that's what happens to Gideon. And there are troubling aspects to Gideon. Notice that they reference him as Jerubbaal again here. They use his Canaanite name instead of his Jewish name. And the phrase there that showed thy kindness, that's the covenant language. It seems like this was a king who served you, who fought for you, who risked his life for you, and this is what you've extended to him at the end of the chapter. You didn't treat him well. And normally at this point in the story, this judges cycle would be over and we'd be moving into a new judge cycle, right? And all of them start just like this. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. But this story isn't finished. We get an extra chapter 9 is kind of jammed into a place where we wouldn't normally expect it. But the author wants us to know what happened. After Gideon fell off the wagon a bit spiritually, he wants to show you the effects of what that was on his son. Okay? And the ethical and spiritual seed sown by Gideon comes to full bloom in the life of his son. Remember, Abimelech's name means my father, the king. Okay? And he is going to take that name very seriously in how he conducts himself. So when we look at chapter 9, okay, and I know this is a long introduction, but as we get to chapter 9, notice that, number one, we're talking about the house of Jerubbaal, not the house of Gideon, specifically using his Canaanite name. Number two, we don't hear Yahweh's name. We hear the generic idea of Elohim. Okay, so Yahweh is silent again in chapter 9. He is not referenced, and when God is referenced, it's in the most generic way possible. Okay, it reads like a Canaanite history book. It doesn't read like a Bible chapter. Okay, these are not, you know, in almost every chapter we've had judges appealing to God and calling out to God for help and those kinds of things. That's not how chapter 9 is going to read. And then for the first time, we don't have an external threat. We don't have Amalekites and Midianites and Ammonites and all kinds of people coming in and taking over. We have internal politics, okay, which, you know, we always try to kind of bring this into modern times. What did the founding fathers always say about what the downfall of America would be? It said it won't be the foreign enemies. It'll be from the inside out. Okay? If we fall apart morally and ethically on the inside, it won't be long until the nation falls. And again, we can look around and see a lot of evidence of that, right? There's a focus on Shechem, a Canaanite city, okay, which is where Abimelech is from. So that is going to kind of take over the focus of major city of the chapter. And again, Yahweh does not speak in chapter 9. So here to set up our discussion is Romans 6:16, where Paul wrote, "Do you not know that if you present yourselves to anyone as obedient slaves, you are slaves of the one whom you obey?" And he uses as a spiritual application, either of sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to righteousness. But if you allow yourself to be a slave, you will be a slave. And that could be a king, that could be a government, that could be many different things. And so when we see that, watch what the people of Shechem are going to do in trusting Abimelech in this chapter. All right, chapter 9. And I didn't want to give anything away in chapter 9, so we're going to take it a verse or two at a time. "And Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal," not Gideon, but Jerubbaal, "went to Shechem unto his mother's brethren." Remember, Abimelech is the son of Gideon's concubine in Shechem. Not his wife, but his concubine. Okay? "Unto his mother's brethren, and communed with them, and with all the family of the house of his mother's father, saying, speak, I pray you, in the ears of all the men of Shechem." So see what's going on here. He's got his family. And he says, I need you guys to go talk to all the elders in the city, all the nobles, all the important people. Go talk to them. I need you to get this word out. And you wonder why the family had notoriety. Well, I think the fact that maybe his mother was concubine to the king maybe have elevated them in this pagan society. That would have probably been a status symbol. Okay? "Whether is better for you, either that all the sons of Jerubbaal, which are 70, again, 70, persons reign over you, or that one reign over you. Remember also that I am your bone and your flesh." Okay? So Abimelech's a politician. And he's got a plan here. Okay? Which brings to this whole, my wife will be happy about this because it's psychology, right? The age-old argument of nature versus nurture. Anybody familiar with that discussion? If you've taken a psychology class, you probably talked about that. But and it's prevalent still today because you hear it in all the LGBT discussions, the transgender discussions, all that. This is always there. And so the question between nature and nurture is, are you born a certain way or is it your environment that creates who you are? Okay? And I would say yes. Because from a spiritual perspective, we are born with a sin nature. We are born with certain proclivities and things like that. But it is your environment that forms who you are in most cases, right? There's been plenty of case studies on that. And so when we think about Abimelech, by nature, he's the son of Gideon, who has plenty of faults. And you can imagine his mother is the one that's not the wife. He's probably treated less important than the rest of the other 70 sons. There's probably some anger. There's probably some frustration. He probably inherits all that. So you combine the nature of where he comes from as a son and the nurture of the environment that he was raised up in, and you got a pretty dangerous combination going on with Abimelech. I think he has some natural proclivities, and his environment just makes those explode when he's raised up. So Abimelech's conduct here, perhaps inspired by his own name, Abimelech moves to Shechem, the home of his concubine mother, determined to carve out his own kingdom. And he has a plan, and he's going to enlist his relatives to secure the support of Shechem, which tells you that Shechem's a really important city at this point in time. A couple commentators write, the inhabitants of Shechem, the worshippers of Baal-Berith, carried out the election of Abimelech as king in the very same place in which Joshua had held the last national assembly. There's some irony here. Joshua had held an assembly of the entire nation of Israel here and talked about blessings and cursings in this exact same city. And they have a pagan altar set up in the exact same spot, and that's where they're going to put the crown on Abimelech. Okay? You talk about how far the nation has fallen in a very short amount of time. Okay? So according to the biblical text, Abimelech was the first person ever to be formally crowned king in Israel. It's not Saul. So maybe if somebody asks you the trivia question, you can you know, say, well, actually, technically, you know, people love it when you do that. you know, technically, it's Abimelech. But it's not all of Israel. It's not God. It's not formal kingship. But he's the first one to be said, we want you to be our king. Okay? So, but this is definitely pagan support. This is not a God-ordained thing. Okay? These are Canaanites doing this, or a mixed multitude at the very least. We're going to see in verse 4 that these men finance his campaign with money from the temple, from the pagan temple. They're going to finance the campaign with money from the pagan temple. Okay? You know, talk about like campaign finance reform and all that. This would probably be frowned upon if you're getting money from the pagan temple. And these same men will later seek asylum in that temple when they're in trouble. So this is their God, and this is the same God that Israel is worshiping right now. Shechem is very influential. And Abimelech opens with a rhetorical question, right? Well, which is better, guys? Would you rather be ruled by 70 men or would you rather be ruled by one man? Okay, that's his first question. And he says, you know, you really want to deal with 70 different rulers? Which probably tells us that Gideon's sons are doing some sort of ruling at this point. And they're doing enough ruling where there are enough people frustrated with them that Shechem is able to do this. So I'm not saying that all these 70 sons are just great leaders and this was... But they're probably leading. So would you rather follow those 70 or would you rather follow one? And then he says, but which is better? Would you rather be ruled by a relative, somebody that's your flesh and blood, or some stranger? Hey, okay? And they go, well, it makes a lot of sense. I'd rather have one guy that was my relative. Right. And Abimelech says, I'm that guy. Right. I'm connected to Gideon. I'm important. I've got a good family name. I can help you out. Right? You're my brothers. You know, I haven't talked to you in a lot of years, but you know, I'm really close to you guys. Right? I can help you out. He's really, he's fracturing his family right now, right? He is splitting them apart. They're strangers. We're good. Okay? I will help you. We'll get rid of them. That's what he's doing in order to elevate himself into power. Okay? Verse 3. And his mother's brethren spake of him in the ears of all the men of Shechem. They listened to him. All these words. And their hearts inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our brother. And they gave him 70 pieces, again, 70 pieces of silver, out of the house of Baal-Berith, wherewith Abimelech hired vain and light persons which followed him. Now, that doesn't tell us anything in the King James language. Vain and light persons. I'll talk about that in a second as we get here. They agree to finance his campaign to overthrow the existing rulers. They provide him with pagan treasury money to hire assassins or hitmen. And it's one piece of silver for each prospective target. So talk about cheap, right? There are 70 sons of Gideon and they're worth a shekel apiece. That's what they give him out of the treasury. Okay. You know, and there's a long tradition of buying off people with pieces of silver in the Bible, right? We'll see it again. The men are hired to commit the murders are described as vain and light. The Net Bible says that means lawless and dangerous. The literal translation, which doesn't work real well for us either, is reckless adventurers, you know, which doesn't work either. But probably the best way to translate it is lawless, dangerous, worthless. These are worthless men. These men have no honor. Okay, those are the people that they have hired to go do this job with the pagan blood money that we've got going on. So in verse 5, get in, Abimelech's plan is in motion. And he went unto his father's house at Ophrah and slew his brethren, the sons of Jerubbaal, being 70 persons upon one stone. Notwithstanding, yet Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. So he kills he kills 69 out of 70 brothers, right? And it says he killed them on one stone. Okay? So this was not, we go from house to house and we're taking people out. I mean, the other times that this phrase is used on one stone, it has to do with animal sacrifices. Okay? So to paint the picture of what's going on here, this is a full-scale execution. He takes his team of hitmen. He goes 30 miles from Shechem to Ophrah. They find the half-brothers, and again, upon one stone. It's a calculated execution, a brutal act of murder, in which his unsuspecting brothers are serially murdered one after another. So they're just brought in, killed, next one brought in, killed. It's an entire execution of 69 of his brothers. Okay? One manages to get away because he hides himself. The youngest hides himself, but 69 are killed. Okay, so you want to talk about, there's no spin you could put on this story to say, well, maybe he was justified. No, that he didn't overthrow a king. He killed 69 of his brothers in a brutal execution-style killing. Okay, 68, yeah, because of him, right? Yeah, so 68, yeah, because he had to have the perfect 70. There you go. Okay, this is a lot like 2 Kings chapter 10. And if you want to flip over there while I'll give you some background here. There's a parallel here, and I think there's an interesting parallel, because in 2 Kings chapter 10, it is a man named Jehu. Okay? And Jehu was made king over Israel kind of out of nowhere. He was a general, and Elisha sends a prophet to go and anoint him king. And what he does is he ends up killing the son of Ahab, Joram, and the king of Judah, Ahaziah, in the middle of a field there at Jezreel. They ride down on chariots and they say, "Is it peace, Jehu?" And he says, "Nope." And he kills them both. Shoots them with arrows in their chariot. He also killed Jezebel. Chucked her out the window, if you remember that whole thing. And some dogs come along and there's not much left. and all that. Then, this is after all that. So Joram is dead, Ahaziah is dead, and Jezebel is dead at this point. And Jehu goes to the palace in 2 Kings chapter 10, and there's some interesting parallels. See if you can pick some up to our story that we've got going on here. Okay, 2 Kings 10:1, and Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. Okay, remember, 70 was the pagan ideal for the pagan god El had 70 sons, and so a pagan king wanted to have 70 sons. And Gideon had 70 sons, and Ahab had 70 sons. Okay? And remember, Ahab was married to Jezebel, who was from like Baal's hometown. Like, there was nothing good about Jezebel. She brought pagan worship all into Israel. Okay? And Jehu wrote letters and sent to Samaria unto the rulers of Jezreel to the elders. What did Abimelech do? He went to the elders of Shechem. Jehu goes to the elders in Samaria, or to Jezreel. And to them that brought up Ahab's children, saying, "Now as soon as this letter comes to you, seeing your master's sons are with you, and there with you chariots and horses, a fenced city also in armor, look even out the best and meetest your master's son, and set him on his father's throne, and fight for your master's house." But they were exceedingly afraid, and said, "Behold, two kings stood not before him. How then shall we stand?" So basically he says, "I'm coming, and if you want to fight, this is when I'm coming." And they go, "That's cool. He just killed the king and the other king. What can we do?" And he that was over the house and he that was over the city, the elders also and the bringers up of the children, sent to Jehu, saying, "We are thy servants and will do all that thou shalt build us. We will not make any king. Do thou that which is good in thine eyes." Then he wrote a letter to the second time to them, saying, "If ye be mine and if ye will hearken unto my voice, take you the heads of the men, your master's son, and come to me in Jezreel tomorrow this time." Now the king's son, being 70 persons, were with the great men of the city, which brought them up. And it came to pass, when the letter came to them, that they took the king's sons and slew 70 persons and put their heads in baskets and sent them to Jezreel. And there came a messenger and told him, saying, "They have brought the heads of the king's sons." And he said, "Lay them in two heaps at the entering into the gate until the morning." And it came to pass in the morning that he went out and stood and said to all the people, "You be righteous. Behold, I conspired against my master and slew him. But who slew all these?" And know now that there shall fall unto each earth nothing of the word of the Lord which the Lord spake concerning the house of Ahab, for the Lord has done that which he spake by his servant Elijah. Okay, so I know that's a gruesome story. Okay, but do you see the parallels there that are going on? But there are some differences. So the parallels are this. Both fathers, Gideon and Ahab, ruled with a high hand, murdering their own countrymen. Okay, the number of sons is explicitly 70 in both cases. The conspiracy against the sons is led by an ambitious and unlikely individual, Jehu and Abimelech, guys that came out of nowhere. Okay, the leader of the coup is an outsider who secures the support of the nobles of the city, both Shechem and at Jezreel. The 70 sons are brutally and summarily murdered. And the leader of the coup is an outsider who is publicly acclaimed king. Both groups come and publicly say, you can be our king now after the murders happen. But there's an important difference. 2 Kings 10:10 says, now know that there shall fall unto the earth nothing of the word of the Lord, which the Lord spake concerning the house of Ahab, for the Lord had done that which he spake by his servant Elijah. Remember, Elijah had prophesied to Ahab when he did the whole Naboth's vineyard deal. And they killed off Naboth. They said, your blood will fall on this ground. And Ahab repents. And then Elijah says, well, you won't die on this field, but your sons will die on this field. And so what was Jehu doing? He was fulfilling the prophecy that Elijah had made against Ahab years earlier. That was a God-ordained thing. That's why he's kind of upset when the people kill him and cut off all the heads and all that. Okay, Judges 9. It says this in verse 24, that the cruelty done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come, and their blood be laid upon Abimelech, their brother, which slew them, and upon the men of Shechem, which aided him in the killing of his brethren. This was not of God. Okay? Abimelech did not go kill his brothers because God ordained it and told him to do so. Okay? Abimelech did this because he was selfish and wanted the power. And the men of Shechem were aiding and abetting that same murder. Okay? It's a totally different situation. So parallels of stories, but also a very important difference in the motivation. Okay? Verse 6, if I can get back to Judges. And all the men of Shechem gathered together and all the house of Millo and went and made Abimelech king by the plain of the pillar that was in Shechem. So what that means is that the pillar was always a pagan installation. So they crowned him king beside a pagan worship site there in Shechem. Okay, now, we got a little hint there back in verse, 4 or 5 there, where Jotham survives, the youngest son, hides himself, and manages not to die. Okay, so he's hidden, he's escaped death, and in contrast to Abimelech, whose name reflects his ambition, Jotham's name means the Lord is perfect, or the Lord is honest. So my father, the king, is grabbing the throne for himself, and now the youngest son, the Lord is perfect, is going to come and address his brother and the people of Shechem. Now, Jotham has no power. He has no prospects. He has no family. He's the only one left. Okay? So he's not like he can walk into the city because he just watched all his brothers killed. He's not going to walk into the city. So there's a threat on his life. And so he's going to go up to a mountain right there by the city, and he's going to proclaim a message. So the rest of our time will be spent with Jotham's message. Okay, verse 7. And when they told it to Jotham, he went and stood in the top of Mount Gerizim and lift up his voice and cried and said unto them, hearken unto me, you men of Shechem, that God may hearken unto you. Okay, so what is he saying there? He's claiming that he's speaking for who? For God. I have a message from God. It's almost like he's claiming to be a prophet right now. I have a message from God. So if you ever want to have a relationship with God again, it would do you well to listen to what I have to say to you. Listen to me if you ever want God to listen to you. Now, the picture doesn't look real great there, but let me try to explain everything here. This is Shechem, okay? Modern day city is Nablus. It's right there in Israel, okay? This is Mount Gerizim on this side. This is Mount Ebal on this side. Okay. Now, if you remember, in Deuteronomy, Moses gathers the people of Israel in this spot and proclaims the law to them. Okay. Reads the entire law to them. Joshua brings the entire nation of Israel to this spot. They put 6 tribes on this side and 6 tribes on this side. They pronounce the blessings of God from Mount Gerizim. They pronounce the cursings or the curses of God from Mount Ebal, and that's where Joshua will famously say, you choose who you serve, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, right? He says, you know the law. We've just said the entire law. Choose this day who you're going to serve, right? And that's where he leaves it. So the last time the entire nation, all 12 tribes were together, was in this spot. And on the Mount of Blessings, right up here, which probably forms a natural amphitheater where everybody can hear down there in the town, is where Jotham is going to set up and give his big speech. Okay, so that's where he goes. It's an important location. By the way, why is Mount Gerizim important in the New Testament? You didn't know I was going to ask you questions tonight. Okay. Why is it important in the New Testament? No, not Transfiguration. It is Mount Gerizim is in the middle of Samaria. Okay. Now, with New Testament, the town of Sychar is like right up here. Okay. If you remember Sychar, that is where Jesus met the woman at the well. Right. And remember the discussion that they have. And she says, you know, our people say that the temple is here on this mountain. You say it's in Jerusalem. The Samaritans set up a temple on Mount Gerizim because the Samaritans didn't like going into Judea, and the Judeans didn't, you know, Samaritans, they don't like Jews and Jews don't like Samaritans. So they set up their own temple, their own worship, their own stuff up on Mount Gerizim. So this mountain is pretty important to Scripture. It's a good one to know. Okay, so Jotham gives a little preamble there that we just talked about. Hearken unto me, you men of Shechem, that God may hearken unto you. And notice that Jotham does not attack Abimelech directly. Okay, he wouldn't fit well with American politics. He doesn't just get up and start bad-mouthing the other candidate. Well, first of all, he's not interested in being a candidate. Right? He doesn't go after Abimelech. He's going to address the leaders of Shechem, and he's going to say, what kind of people are you? That's what he's going to appeal to here. Is, do you realize what you've done and what you're doing? I don't care about him. What are you doing? Because he can't do this on his own. He needs you to back him up. He needs an army. He needs men. He needs money. So you have to back him up. So I want you to consider what you're doing. He's hoping that they'll listen to godly counsel. It's what God did with the prophets many times, right? Remember when he tells Jeremiah, they're not going to listen to you? They're going to reject what you say, but I want you to go say it to them anyway, because they're going to have no excuse. We're going to give them the counsel they need, and they'll know when they reject it. So Jotham's fable, it's about trees, and the trees want a king. And I thought, if you want a king tree, it's got to be Groot, right? Or Treebeard from Lord of the Rings, if you really want to get nerdy tonight. And they could have an Entmoot. But here's his fable. Okay, a fable is what? You listen to them when you were kids, right? You always got a moral, and it's usually non-human characters that are in the story, right? That's a fable. It's Animal Farm. It's the tortoise and the hare. You know, it's those kinds of things. So the story is that there were trees that went forth on a time to anoint a king over them. Okay, that's the fable. There were a bunch of trees that were sitting around and said, you know what? We need a king. We need to find a king of the trees. Okay, and there's three stages. He couldn't do Groot without Baby Groot, so we had to put him on there too. Okay, and they're going to go to three trees or three plants. They're going to go to an olive tree, a fig tree, and a grapevine. And these are going to be what you would call three prime candidates. These are good trees that they're going to go and ask. So we'll start with, let me give you a little more. The first three trees represent the three most prized domestic plants in Israel. The olive tree, the fig tree, and the grapevine that produces the wine. Okay. Notice that we're going to see when we read this, all three are going to decline the offer of kingship because they're too busy serving the nation to be a selfish and overpowering king. The trees don't want to rule. They want to function as God intended them to rule. Okay, it's an interesting little fable we've got going on here. So let's start with the olive tree in verse 8. The trees went forth on a time to anoint a king over them, and they said unto the olive tree, reign thou over us. But the olive tree said unto them, should I leave my fatness wherewith by me they honor God and man and go to be promoted over the trees? Olive oil was probably the most valuable product in the ancient world. They used it for everything. Okay? Olive oil is still a big export in Israel. Okay? All those, you know, pretentious cooks on TV use olive oil every time they cook, right? So it was used as cooking oil, medicine, lubricant, leather softener, fuel, perfume, and it was used in all the sacred offerings and anointings. Okay, so olive oil was a big money crop. It was important then. It's important now. So, of course, they go to him first. Rule over us. All right? And he says, why would I leave this to go be a king? This is more important than being a king. Okay? Then he goes to the fig tree in verse 10. And the tree said to the fig tree, come thou and reign over us. But the fig tree said unto them, should I forsake my sweetness and my good fruit and go to be promoted over the trees? Okay, the fruit of the fig could be eaten fresh. It could be made into cakes, fig wine. It was used as a sweetener. And when you think about the symbolism in Scripture, I mean, the olive tree is all over Scripture. Israel is often described as an olive tree. Okay, and the fig tree is all over. I mean, how many times did Jesus use the fig tree as an illustration? Right. So we don't understand it as well because we're not as agricultural. But these images would have been very, you know, it would have lit up a Jewish listener's face because they know exactly what they mean. Those are important plants that are going on here. Okay? And number three, he goes to the grapevine in verse 12. Then said the trees unto the vine, come thou and reign over us. And the vine said unto them, should I leave my wine, which cheers God and man, and go to be promoted over the trees? Every single one of them rejects the idea of being a king, right? Because what we do now in serving the people is more important than for me to get power and reign over all the other trees. Okay? So the olive tree would rather honor others than be anointed with its own oil. Like, my oil anoints kings. Why would I want to be a king, right? And number two, the fig tree refused to stop producing sweetness for others. And the grapevine was too vital for both secular and sacred pursuits. Man loves wine. God, you know, with the offerings and all the different ceremonies, right? And we'll see that even more in the New Testament as well. Okay, none of these trees want to be king. So three candidates refuse. You know, it's like if you're on a, you know, college football coaching search and you're down to coach number four. You know, you're not as excited about coach number four as you were about coach number one that turned your job down. And candidate number four is a little different than the others. Okay, so verse 14 and 15. Then said all the trees unto the bramble or the thorn bush, come thou and reign over us. And the bramble said unto the trees, if in truth you anoint me king over you, then come and put your trust in my shadow, and if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. A little different response there, right? Okay. The bramble, the thorn bush, and we're not talking about roses here. We're talking about a thorn bush, okay? It has absolutely nothing positive to contribute to human or sacred life. It's not olive oil, it's not the fig, it's not the wine, it's a thorn bush, right? And so there's nothing there. Thorns represent the curse, right? Genesis 3:18. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. The reason when sin comes into the world, thorns come into the world. Okay? Along with like cockroaches and wasps, I think. that's my number one question when I get to heaven. Why, Lord? Why those? You ever think about wasps? They don't even make the honey or anything. They're just little balls of hate. That's all they are. I got attacked by a bunch of wasps when I was four, so I still have hard feelings about it. It's like one of my first memories was getting swarmed by wasps at 4 years old. Okay. So remember Judges 8:16. Gideon, when he went back to the city there in the Transjordan, he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Sukkoth. Remember, he threshed them with thorns for punishment. The brambles in this culture, and probably still today, were often the source of wildfires because they were dried out wood. And so this is where wildfires started. But nothing good about brambles. And we'll see this in a second. But notice what the bramble says. It says, come and trust in my shadow. Come and stand in my shade. You're a thorn bush, man. Like there's nothing there to stand under. Like I'm not getting shade under that. And nothing good is going to happen. And notice how he accepts. He doesn't accept. He doesn't even trust him. He says, if you want me to be king, it's almost like, you know, come on in here. If you want me to be king, come in here and show me you trust me. Put your trust in my shadow. The net says, find safety under my branches. So if you're looking for safety, you're going to crawl into the thorn bush. Like, not unless you're Brer Rabbit, but other than that, you're not going to do that. Old Disney reference for four people there. Okay? And the ESV says, take refuge in my shade. You're not getting shade from a thorn bush. It's a lie from the beginning. It's false hope from the beginning. So finding trust and safety and refuge in a thorn bush is just absurd. But that's what he offers them. Okay? That's what he says. If you want to be my king, you got to trust in my shade that doesn't exist. You got to trust in all the promises that I can't fulfill. That's what he's saying to him. And the bramble's kind of paranoid, right? In case the trees were playing games with him, He says, if you really want to be king and you don't trust me, you won't come in and trust in my shade. He says, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. Now, the significance there is the cedars of Lebanon were the biggest trees in the world. The biggest, strongest, toughest trees in the world. They brought them down to build the temple, right? That's what the cedars of Lebanon are. And so he says, let fire come out of me and consume the cedars of Lebanon. And notice the egotism there. Notice the selfishness there. Because the bramble itself is the source of the fire. Fire will come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon. I'm more important than the cedars of Lebanon. Okay? He's the authority. And he will not be king over any trees. I'm going to be king over the cedars of Lebanon. Like, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Right? Once I get a little bit of power, I'm going to want more power. Okay? The most majestic trees on the earth are going to be subject to the little thorn bush. That's what he wants. Okay? Who would choose such a king? All right? Well, that's what he's telling Shechem. That's what you've just chosen. You've just chosen the thorn bush to be king over you. Okay? And verse 16, I love the rhetorical device here. He says, now therefore, if you have done truly and sincerely, can you see kind of the sarcasm going there? If you've done truly and sincerely in that you have made Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house and have done unto him according and deserving of his hands. Okay, and it brings to mind some Shakespeare for me. You know, I've been hitting a lot of Shakespeare in this section. I didn't plan on it, but it's there. And if anybody's read Julius Caesar, after Brutus and Cassius and the rest of the conspirators kill Caesar, spoiler alert, Caesar died in Ides of March. After they kill him, they want to get in. They want Mark Antony, who was Caesar's right-hand man, to be with them. Right? We need Mark Antony on our side. Of course, Cassius says we don't need him, but Brutus wants him. Right? And so he says we're going to let Mark Antony speak to the people. And when they say when Mark Antony's on our side, they'll go, "Oh, well, it must have been justified, and we'll follow them." Okay? And Mark Antony gets up to give his speech, and of course you've probably heard the first part, which is, "Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him." And then he goes on to praise Caesar entirely in the whole speech. But this is what Mark Antony does. It's just a little section. But he gets up and he says, "Here under the leave of Brutus and the rest," for Brutus is an honorable man. Right? This is his catchphrase throughout the whole speech. You know, "Brutus, let me speak." And Brutus, he's an honorable man. So are they all these men that just killed Caesar that are covered in blood. They're all honorable men. "Come I to speak in Caesar's funeral. He was my friend, faithful and just to me." But Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. And throughout the entire speech, he says, "You know, remember when Caesar gave all that money to you to build that park, and he kept that money in inheritance so you guys could have it? But Brutus says he was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man." And and people are going, "Wait a second, he's not really that honorable. There all these great things that Caesar did." Not that Mark Antony doesn't have his own agenda, but that's the rhetorical device. And so I think Jotham does the same thing. If you've acted honorably, then go ahead. If you treated my family well by slaughtering 68 of my brothers, okay. If that was honorable, then go ahead forward with this because you're probably doing the right thing. But if not, you might want to check yourself. And so he's going to bookend this speech with, if you've acted truly and honorably, and if you've acted truly and honorably, and Brutus is an honorable man. Okay. So he identifies the main thing. In light of Abimelech's brutality against his own family, the nobles of Shechem are accomplices in the murder of Gideon's sons. And so Jotham conditionally puts that whole thing down on him. Okay? And for a second, he gets personal in 17 and 18. And this, is, I think, is Jotham's heart when we get to these two verses. It says, "For my father fought for you and adventured his life far and delivered you out of the hand of Midian. And you are risen up against my father's house this day and have slain his sons, 70 persons upon one stone, and have made Abimelech, the son of his maidservant, king over the men of Shechem, because he is your brother." Okay? It's almost like he was doing his whole thing and he just got overcome for a second and said, "And while I'm here, my dad fought for you. And he gave everything up for you. And he did this for you and this for you and this for you. And you kill all his sons and you install this guy as king." And it's like, and then he calms down for a second. And he's going to get back to verse 19. "But my father risked his life for Shechem. He fought on Shechem's behalf. He rescued you from Midianite oppression. And you have repaid him with treachery by attacking his house, killing his sons, installing his illegitimate son of a Canaanite concubine as king just because he's your brother. That's what you've done." Okay? And then 19 and 20. "If you then have dealt truly and sincerely with Jerubbaal and with his house this day, then rejoice, you and Abimelech. All right? If you've done truly and honorably, rejoice. And let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and the house of Millo. And let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from the house of Millo and devour Abimelech. Okay? So, what do we got going on here? If you've dealt truly, party on. If you haven't, may fire consume you and him. It's a curse from the Mount of Blessings. It's curse formula. If you've done honorably, well, then God bless you. But if you have not acted honorably in this, a curse is coming. Okay? And that's what he lays out for them. And they're not real happy about that. Okay? He says, let the two parties of this treacherous alliance destroy each other. Like the fable, let the bramble, who's Abimelech, consume the cedars of Lebanon. That's the men of Shechem. But there's more. He adds the other part, too. Let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from the house of Millo and devour Abimelech. So I hope he destroys you and you destroy him. Everybody's going to pay for this. Okay? Abimelech doesn't get off scot-free for this. You will all pay. Okay? So curse isn't used here. But in 957, at the end of this chapter, they're going to call this speech the curse of Jotham. So that's what he's just done, and we'll probably see that come to pass, right? So with Moses and Joshua, Mount Gerizim had been the Mount of Blessing, and both had warned about the all-encompassing depravity of idolatry. They had talked about not worshiping other gods and serving God alone. And now, Jotham stands on that same mountain and curses them because these idolaters have followed an idolatrous king. Okay? The irony is pretty thick. Okay? And 21 is our last verse. And Jotham ran away. Because you can see him scrambling up the mountain to get him at this point. Jotham runs away, and he fled and went to Beer, or Bear. He doesn't actually go to Beer. it's Hebrew. And he dwelt there for fear of Abimelech, his brother. We don't know where that is, but Beer, or Bear, there's a town in Israel called Beersheba, which you may have seen in Scripture. Abraham digs a well there, and Bear means well. So there's a chance, because it just says he ran to well. Well, he may have been hiding out in a well. He might have been hiding in a cistern to get away from his brother for a time. That may have been what it was. And maybe it wasn't a specific city. His life is so threatened out on the road that he has to hide in a well to get away from him and escape his brother. So here's our modern applications, and we'll be done. Kingly power is self-destructive. And destructive of the ones it is designed to protect. Okay? If a man is given absolute power, no matter how many promises he makes, he tends not to protect the people that he promised to do. You pick the dictator and tell me the one that worked out well. Right? Go around and find your Hitlers and your Stalins and your Castros and your Kim Jong-ils and tell me which one worked out well. Okay? Honorable people have no time for political machinations and agendas, which is exactly what Abimelech is doing here. Kings desire power for the worst reasons. The bramble just wants to consume everything. And then people are often given the leaders that they deserve. Okay? People are often given the lead. Again, we talked about it last week. If we throw morality out and throw character out and throw ethics out, don't be surprised when your leaders represent that. Okay? Don't be surprised. The candidates are, they came out of the swamp. Right? The swamp was made because we took all the barriers away and it got all messed up. They're the swamp things that came out. Right? We've created that, and I don't mean we, but America has created that because we made the swamp. So don't expect good things to come pouring out of the swamp. That's what's happened. If you take away morality and character, that's what happens. So what does this mean for us? Okay? Your heart is a lot like Israel. There is somebody or something ruling in your heart. As we speak, there is someone or something ruling in your heart. And if you displace that, you have created a vacuum. What's going to fill it? Okay, so at salvation, you removed yourself from that position of authority and you allowed Christ to fill the vacuum. Okay? Now, I know that's a binding salvation thing, but from a day-to-day basis, do you push the Holy Spirit out and let other things fill that vacuum? Because the nature will not allow the vacuum. You are driving towards something, someone or something is motivating all your actions. What is it? Okay? What is it that drives you in that direction? So I think there's something here for us personally. I think there's something for us here as a nation. I think there's a lot to learn from this book of Judges. So next week, we'll see the downfall of this wicked king. And that is the last time we'll meet until the new year. So, you know, I'll miss you guys. So make sure you come out next week and don't miss. All right. Let's close in the word of prayer. Father, thank you for today. Thank you for this time and more time in your word. And thank you for just the time that we can have together to even fellowship during preaching and have a good time and build relationships and help us to stay focused on that. And then, Lord, let us understand the wickedness of our hearts and the vacuums that are created there. Lord, we want you to fill it. We want your spirit to fill it. We want you to be the driving force in our lives. And help us to do that, Lord. Help us to submit. Help us to fall at your feet and not be tempted to grab the power like the bramble, like Abimelech does in our story. Bless us and keep us as we go, Lord. Give us opportunities this week to serve you. In Jesus' name, amen.